This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett. Well, you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Before I turn to my special guests, I'd like to mention, especially for those who are new to 9/11 research, which will be our subject today, that there are two new books appearing now that Amazon is combining on a special, namely a new book from David Ray Griffin entitled Debunking 9/11 Debunking, which takes apart the kind of work that has come from Popular Mechanics and other sources criticizing 9/11 research. Unlike the critics, Popular Mechanics, for example, which has no footnotes, no certification, and mostly depends upon very general responses for its criticism of 9/11 research, Griffin's book is extremely thorough and meticulous and painstaking and provides an excellent antidote to the critics of criticism of the government's account. The other book is one that I had the pleasure to edit, entitled The 9/11 Conspiracy, The Scamming of America, where I have brought together contributions from 11 different experts on different aspects of the case, including David Ray Griffin. There is a photographic section by Jack White, simply excellent, work by Judy Wood, the leading scientific investigator of 9/11, Joseph P. Firmage, Morgan Reynolds, Rick Ratcher, Elias Davidson, Peter Dale Scott, John McMurtry addressed the meaning of 9/11. It's a wonderful volume, and I highly recommend it. And I can say that because the contributors did such a wonderful job. It was a pleasure to edit. Today, I'm greatly honored to have as my guest Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist in the Department of Labor of the George W. Bush administration, who, notwithstanding his strong Republican credentials, has become a leading critic of the administration. Morgan has particularly focused on the planes that were involved on 9/11 and what happened to them, what became of them, or even whether there were any planes involved at all. There are a number of very interesting issues involved here, and I would like to point out that I find Morgan's work quite fascinating, but that does not mean that I am convinced. My own personal take has been that, in all probability, the planes that hit the World Trade Center were militarized versions of 767s that carried a larger fuel load, and that would create a more spectacular fireball. But Morgan has produced a lot of anomalies he has discovered in the photographic record, anomalies that seem to me to raise very serious questions about what was going on here. At the very least, it seems to me that Morgan Reynolds is putting together a very persuasive case that something is definitely wrong with the photographic record. And if that's the case, if Morgan's research is well-founded, and this is something we'll discuss today, then it raises a question parallel to a question that could be raised about Lee Oswald, where in the study of the JFK assassination I discovered so much evidence had been faked or fabricated or phony that Oswald was really convicted in the mind of the public with manufactured evidence. If the man was guilty, then why was it necessary to frame him? And in a similar way, I think we have to ask, if there really were planes involved, you know, the planes the government claims, then why was it necessary to fabricate so much of the footage? That's the kind of question Morgan's research raises. Great pleasure to have you on the program, Morgan. Welcome to the Dynamic Duo.
Thank you, Jim.
I'd like to start anywhere you like. I know you have looked at all four planes in all four cases, and you have a wonderful chapter in the 9/11 conspiracy. Maybe we might start with the Pentagon as a preliminary point of departure, since I think our research dovetails in that instance that whatever hit the Pentagon, it most certainly was not a Boeing 757.
Well, if I could shift the agenda, I think we're going to have so little time, I'd rather just go to the World Trade Center issue and base it on my request for correction with NIST.
That was the big event of this past week, is the submission of requests for correction from Ed Haas, from Morgan Reynolds, and from Judy Wood under the Data Quality Act, which Jerry Liepart, a 9/11 activist attorney whom we'll have on here in our second hour, organized. Morgan, that's perfectly appropriate. Let's go ahead. This is
okay.
These are requirements or requests that the government reconsider because it's the evidence on which it's basing its reasoning or its reasoning itself is faulty and flawed and therefore doesn't satisfy the conditions of the act.
And since we only have this first hour, we're going to be pressed for time anyway. But let me read this initial statement. My attorney has asked that I read the following statement at the beginning of this radio broadcast. I have filed a request for correction with the National Institute for Standards and Technology and have received confirmation that the RFC is pending. I'm also aware that the content of my RFC has been posted on the website of the U.S. Department of Commerce's Office of Chief Information Officer. My counsel has indicated I can call attention to what is in the text of the RFC because it is a public document. However, I cannot discuss what might happen next, and I obviously cannot discuss what NIST's response might be, as that is totally up to NIST. I understand NIST has 60 days to respond. We will evaluate the response when it is received. End quote. Okay?
Now, that's very appropriate, Morgan. And of course, any of you who have visited 911scholars.org lately will know that there's a press release that I drafted discussing this because I believe that this event is historic and that these submissions have the potential to shatter the cover-up in the case of the government's concealing what actually happened on 9/11. Please continue, Morgan.
It's kind of interesting, Jim, in that until Jerry discovered this method of acting to challenge the government's story, I was hadn't done the homework on the NIST document, but it's appalling. But I want to pull out some pieces out of this document, this RFC I filed, which is 18 pages in total, but really it's only about 10 or so pages of real content here. My first point is that all the videos that focus on the South Tower don't show any collision or crash. In other words, the building absorbs the jetliner image, and further, there is no deceleration, and the NIST report actually agrees with me on that. There is no deceleration. Rick Ryder, my co-author at MIT, we had one article in your volume that you endorsed, and I endorse it too, by the way. I think it turned out quite well. Rick did a very careful analysis, and there is virtually no measurable deceleration in the jetliner image. Okay, well, the second, so that's really troubling now, isn't it?
Well, presumably, right. If, an airliner impacts with something, massive and hard, there ought to be some kind of collision taking place that is going to be manifest.
There's got to be a collision. This is Physics 1A.
Yeah.
And yet, the videos do not show a collision or a crash.
That's right, that's right. We'll return to this point with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. We're discussing the planes on 9/11. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Morgan Reynolds, who's been investing a lot of time and effort in studying the video and other evidence in relation to the planes that may or may not have been involved on 9/11. Morgan, I'm sure our audience would be fascinated to know why in the world the government might have, fabricated evidence of aircraft if aircraft weren't actually involved. I'm discovering Webster Tarpley has a theory about why the plane in Shanksville might have been blown out of the sky rather than allowed to crash or allowed to land, even if the passengers had been able to take control of it. He says on page 263 of his revised edition of Synthetic Terror, an aircraft safely landed meant in all probability living hijackers who could have been interrogated. What would their cover story have been? What would they have been revealed about their own intentions, their own understanding of what they were doing? Would the testimony have exploded the official version? And of course, what if there simply were no hijackers on board? The official version would fall to the ground. it was a risk that the terrorist controllers could not afford to run.
Well, that gets at the heart of why they did it this way. There are many factors that go into it, but the summation is doing it the way the media and government portrayed had way too many risks of something going wrong and the whole thing being exposed. So they kept it simple, and then they have the ultimate backstop, which is complete control of the, I want to call it the state-run media, the official media, who could cover, you know, do the PSYOP, especially when people were disoriented and confused and terrorized.
We have a stunning illustration of this when a couple of weeks ago archival footage was discovered showing a BBC reporter announcing that a third skyscraper, the building number 7, which he was referring to as the Solomon Brothers building, had collapsed at 4:57 in the afternoon, when in fact the building didn't collapse until 5:20, and you could actually see over her left shoulder building 7 standing perfectly solidly in the background. It was a rather stunning and shocking indication of what you're suggesting, Morgan.
One thing I came across recently was that Pilots for 9/11truth.org, the principal there was interviewing John Lear, the son of famous Learjet fame,
yeah,
who's a commercial pilot. And by the by, the principal pointed out that on the morning of 9/11, there were a couple of pilots on a flight simulator, and they tried to simulate them and experience multi-engine heavy Boeing pilots running a plane into a tower at 500 miles an hour, and they tried it 5 or 6 times and couldn't do it.
I think that's quite fascinating, Morgan. I read the same report. That it was stunning.
Yes.
Just as I would surmise that a reason for not using a Boeing at the Pentagon was that there were practical matters at hand. For example, it appears as though destroying a group of budget analysts who were trying to track the $2.3 trillion Rumsfeld had announced was missing the day before may have been a principal motive, and that you could do that far more successfully by targeting them with a missile before a smaller plane impacted than any commercial airliner.
So if we go back to my request for correction at NIST, one of the points I make is this first point about the videos do not show a collision or a crash, and further, there is no deceleration. The second major point is that the building, the South Tower, where this event presumably took place, the building actually heals itself up if you go frame by frame and look at some of these individual frames or photos. And even during penetration, when the plane is nearly halfway into the building, you can see that there's an engine and a fuselage, but the wing section connecting the engine to the fuselage is not visible anymore, and there further isn't a break in the building there. In other words, the column failures, the break in the wall that should be there, isn't there. And remember, you have to crash through the columns, the perimeter vertical columns, steel, the spandrel belts, steel, as well as the floors, which are steel and concrete. You know, there's a 7-ton steel pan under that has trusses. So there's a lot of material to crash into. And this is impossible, of course, you know, that you'd have to leave the mark as this event unfolds in hundredths of a second in real time. Then the third anomaly is that this handful of videos do not show a single flap panel, actuator, wingtip, or tail section breaking off. Really, there's nothing disturbed. This goes back to my first point about it's more of an absorption rather than a collision. And as a result, there is no debris associated with the video. So,
well, I got to say, Morgan, you know, I've seen a photograph that you have presented where it looks like the plane is just merging into the building. I know the phrase butter planes has sometimes been used to describe this phenomenon, but it's truly striking when you look at it. Something that makes me open-minded about your work is that I have seen so many different videos videos, some of which show a cruise missile hitting toward the towers that was taken from a helicopter. Others of which show a kind of a high hypersonic plane coming and flashing by the towers. Others which show no planes around the towers at the same time. Others taken from a similar point of view show a plane coming toward the towers. So I got to say, it seems to me that anyone who actually looks at all the evidence out there has to realize it all can't be right. It's very inconsistent. And analysis of what's going on here is indispensable to sort it out.
Yes, and you're getting into the area of what might have happened, and I'm not promoting, I haven't learned enough to really favor any individual theory. What I'm doing is showing that the conventional big Boeing going into towers cannot be true. So I'm taking a narrower point of view and proving in my own words that this couldn't have happened.
You're also a reputation of the government's official account
That's
about
right.
the planes, as opposed
right.
to an explanation of what actually happened.
That's right. And, of course, the reason why I argued that this is so vital, even though it's disturbing and creates more problems for us in educating the public, is that the government needs hijackers, and therefore they need commercial airliners. Well, if there aren't any commercial airliners, they're done. In terms of their war on terror, et cetera, once the public catches on.
That's right. They need the hijackers who have to be Arab or Islamic fundamentalists who are
right.
going to be the focus then of the anger and hostility that's going to be derived from these atrocities being committed here on American soil.
So my claim is that the videos in the South Tower that show penetration, it doesn't matter if there's pods or what the livery is on the plane, they are fake because they show impossible physical events.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest is Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the Bush administration, but now a leading critic of the government's account of 9/11. Morgan, I think you have done such patient and thorough work, for example, in the chapter that you co-authored that appears in the 9/11 conspiracy, that it's very difficult not to believe that the issues you are dealing with are quite serious ones regarding the authenticity of the evidence on which the government's account has been based, which is terribly, terribly important. I mean, I discovered in the course of more than 10 years of research on JFK that not just some, but most of the evidence in that case was altered, faked, or fabricated, which meant that the most important task that I and those with whom I was collaborating confronted was to sort out the authentic from the inauthentic evidence. And once we had done that, it was relatively simple to explain precisely what had happened.
Mm-hmm. And what does that point to? Of course, it points to it had to be an inside job, because whatever the government pointed to, like in the case of Lee Harvey Oswald, couldn't have done any of that.
You're right. We're talking about the alteration of X-rays that were in possession of medical officers of the United States Navy, Secret Service agents, and the President's personal physician, substituting a brain during a second supplemental autopsy examination, somebody else's brain, taking control of and recreating the home movie of the assassination that's come to be known as the Zapruder film. Oswald obviously could have done none of those things, having been incarcerated or already dead. And when you combine all these feats of alteration of crucial medical evidence and physical evidence, and with the 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting him up, there's really little latitude to go anywhere else in terms of assigning responsibility. It was an inside job.
And here's the parallel works so often, and the 19 Arab hijackers alleged, of course, could have done none of this, or the handful of people in caves in Afghanistan. Well, if we go back to the World Trade Center, my fifth point is that the gaseous... Let me just read this little list, and then I want to come back. We can amplify on some of these points. The fifth point I want to make is that the gaseous in the towers are too small and discontinuous to actually absorb a Boeing 767, especially at the South Tower. That the width of that thing is no more than 106 feet, and Boeing 767 is 156 foot wingspan. It's also true that the vertical size of the gash is much too small. Six, there's no airplane debris visible in these gashes, or indeed have I ever seen proof that there's airplane debris below the impact zone, the alleged impact zone. Seventh, there's this whole issue of an invincible plane, an aluminum can, basically, an elaborate aluminum can being invincible and imposing a plane-shaped hole or gash, and then turning fragile within a tenth of a second and shredding itself mostly inside the building. Now, this is a little bit complicated, but you just look at the implausibility of this. How can a plane crash through or into this steel and concrete tower and then suddenly disappear? By contrast, you might say a powerful handgun or rifle would have enough kinetic energy to go right through a thin piece of balsa wood and never lose any energy and come out the other side. Well, that's the kind of problem you're confronted with here. And the shredding thing is a little hard to explain, but we may want to return to that.
Morgan, we have a caller. Would you like to have a question from a listener?
Sure.
Patrick in Kentucky. Patrick, welcome to the Dynamic Duo.
Hello. It's been a while. Hello, gentlemen. I was watching this Flight 93 so-called documentary on the Hitler Channel, History Channel, late Saturday evening. And it was kind of a emotional reactionary, trying to get some kind of emotional reactionary response from the audience, no doubt. And of course, I don't know what you think about the allegations, or if it's true that the Flight 93 did it actually crash into the Kentucky-Ohio border, and the way that they displayed it was that there was a big gigantic crater in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, but there was no evidence of any plane, and making it look as through the reenactment that the FBI agents got there and there was just a big crater and no plane. What do you make of that? And also the four or five, six hijackers, supposed hijackers that were on Flight 93. Well, we have heard that, you know, through a flight training school in Miami or wherever, that they said that there was no way that they could fly these planes. And then why would they set up these Arabs to do this in the first place? And then supposedly they flew them back to Saudi Arabia. Can you comment on this?
Well, I mean, the short of all that is, Patrick, there's not one bit of validated evidence that Arab hijackers did any of this. Now, these people existed. There were some stolen identity people. But what all that amounts to is patsies set up to initiate the war on terror and all the good things that go with it. And I say that sarcastically. Regarding the physical phenomenon at Shanksville, Pennsylvania, I suspect there actually was an airliner or airliner-looking thing there because of the eyewitness reports. But certainly that hole is completely inadequate as a crash site for a Boeing 757. That hole is only 20 feet wide or long, and then by 10 feet and maybe 6 feet deep. And it's just preposterous to believe that that hole absorbed and disappeared such a large aircraft, which has a wingspan of 125 feet, and it's 155 feet long. So, of course, this is Jim and I think essentially agree on this case that all the reports from there by the authorities, there's no blood, there's no bodies, there's no identifiable aircraft pieces. It looks like they did this trash hole and blew it up. One of the interesting, there's a lot of interesting features about that, but you notice the grass in that area is unburned. You know, this plane supposedly carrying 8,000, 10,000 gallons of jet fuel that didn't ignite. There are a few burned trees in the background. So the whole thing...
You might find this interesting. Webster Tarpley makes this observation in discussing Shanksville.
Uh-huh.
Before departing, the FBI made sure that the crime scene was rendered totally opaque. The crater was filled in with dirt to be followed by a layer of topsoil. The scorched trees were cut down and shredded into mulch. The FBI was gone 2 weeks after the crash.
Right. The FBI destroyed the evidence there.
That's really kind of stunning. It raises serious issues, which also emerged in the course of JFK, about the role of the FBI in covering things up, that the administration perpetrates criminal acts, and the role of the FBI isn't, in fact, to investigate, but rather to conceal the truth from the American people.
By the way, the FBI was obligated to play the NTSB and actually do a comprehensive air disaster report, which has never surfaced.
Patrick, I want to thank you for calling. This is Jim Fetzer with my special guest Morgan Reynolds on the Dynamic Duo. We'll be right back. My special guest today is Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration, who's become a leading critic of the government's account of 9/11 and who has focused especially on the role of the aircraft, or what purports to be the role of the aircraft in the government's official account, especially in relation to his analysis of the evidence. Morgan, I hope you might be able to stay on and we can discuss these matters further. I've rearranged the schedule so we can continue for another hour. Does that work for you?
Okay, fine. That's great.
Terrific, terrific, terrific. Now, something I really wanted to emphasize here that I think some of your critics, who have also, you know, turned out to be critics of me, have not understood, that you're focusing on the government's official story in relation to the evidence that the government bases it upon. And, you know, when we find instances like the BBC scandal, where you have a reporter reporting the collapse of Building 7 23 minutes before it occurs, or in the case of JFK, the extensive studies, I published a whole book on this, that has established that the whole movie known as the Zapruder film has been faked. I mean, the government has done these things before. It's hardly surprising there could be collusion between the intelligence agencies and the mass media in order to present false accounts of what has happened in extremely important instances in American history.
Well, some 1,000 employed by the corporate media back in the 1960s, the early 60s, were on the CIA payroll. Right? I mean, that's how extensive this infection control of the corporate media was back then.
That's absolutely right. Carl Bernstein published a piece in the Rolling Stone about 1977 in which he had consulted officials with the CIA who had boasted that their greatest successes had been with Time Life, with CBS, and with the New York Times. And I find it shameful that our nation's newspaper of record should be infiltrated by our intelligence agencies. But on the other hand, if you consider the role of the intelligence agencies, how powerful they have become, and the amount of financial resources, among others, that they have at their disposal, I don't doubt that they have the capacity to subvert the mass media, and that the situation today must be vastly worse than it was then.
Yeah, I recall months ago, maybe a couple of years ago, these things kind of run together about the U.S. Army PSYOP group was on the site of CNN in Atlanta for some weeks. So, anyway, there's a close relationship there. Now, here, if I go back to the details on this request for correction that I filed with NIST through the attorney, Jerry Liepart, one of the most hardcore things, and this is pretty amazing, Jim, is that NIST, by their analysis of the videos, and they look at, they break down supposedly 7 videos which I've listed in my RFC, and here's what they don't really give an ultra clean story, but with respect to the North Tower, they claim at one point that the plane was coming in at 466 miles an hour. Another place they claim 443 miles an hour. But in any event, at one point they say the plane disappeared when it reached the wall within 1/5 seconds. Now, if you do the arithmetic and put that in miles per hour, since the plane is 159 feet long, that translates into 542 miles an hour. In other words, if you travel this 159 feet in a fifth of a second, that's 542 miles an hour. Now, that is staggering, Jim. What that says is that you're going along at, let's say, 466 miles an hour through thin air. You impact the building, and you actually accelerate by 76 miles an hour.
You enter this massive building.
And we taxpayers paid $20 million and employed 200 experts to put out these reports. Now, elsewhere, just to be fair to them, they say it took a quarter second for the tail to disappear into the building. Well, that would mean that the aircraft was traveling at 434 miles an hour. In other words, it would have lost a kind of a minimalist speed. But it's still impossible, you know, such tiny amount of deceleration. Now, if we go to what NIST claims at the South Tower, where allegedly United Airlines Flight 175 went in there, that plane supposedly was traveling at 542 miles an hour, give or take 24 miles an hour, but about roughly 100 miles an hour faster, supposedly. And now they're very firm. They tell only one story here, that the full plane disappeared within a fifth of a second. Well, that translates into 542 miles an hour. So what they're saying is, the plane's going along, stoking at the top speed. Some people question whether a Boeing 767 could really fly that fast with the air resistance at sea level, but let's suppose it could. And it doesn't decelerate at all inside the building. Now, this is just Roadrunner nonsense. You know, it's a cartoon-type physics. It's impossible. An 8-year-old, 6-year-old kid would know this is impossible.
Now, of course, what's going on beneath the surface? In other words, I take it the suggestion has to be, it must be a part of your account, that the government is feeding, controlling the television feed that's supposed to be live, but it's being affected by their manipulation of images, and that's what we're watching on television. So we think we're actually live seeing the planes of the building when we're seeing images of planes, but they don't necessarily correspond to what's actually going on physically in space.
Right. Now, I'm not actually kind of your ultimate expert on all these videos. As many as 36 videos are out there. As I understand it, only one or two were considered to be live feed.
Yeah.
And supposedly that actually did have a 7-second delay, as the media often do, as you know, in radio. And
yes.
So really, they only, in a sense, had to have some kind of blue screen or CGI technology to insert something into the live coverage at the time, and the rest are all showing up in various forms. Only a handful of these things actually show penetration at the South Tower. Now, at the North Tower, there are only two known videos, and of course, they're both highly suspicious. One's the Naudet brothers firefighter video, so-called, that you're well aware of, that is famous. But then later, what was it, 18 months or something later, this Pavel Havel, who's disappeared, showed up with another video of the North Tower. So in any event, NIST is not doing their job in terms of quality assurance here, because, as I say in my RFC, it's not even clear that NIST interviewed the photographers, looked at whether they would testify in court on behalf of the authenticity of it, whether or not these were manipulated. In other words, they haven't done the job by any means that they should. But what's funny, or gallows humor, I guess, is that they're taking these literally, and the no deceleration, they're taking at face value without ever scratching their head and saying, well, this is impossible.
Well, that's a pretty good point, Morgan, because, of course, it's fundamental to critique of the government's account of the death of JFK with the magic bullet theory, which is anatomically impossible, a bullet passing through the base of the back of the neck and exiting the throat because cervical vertebrae intervene, or that the Mannlicher Carcano, which Oswald is alleged to have used, could have fired the bullets that killed the president, since the Mannlicher Carcano is not a high-velocity weapon, and the bullets that are alleged to have killed the president were. And then you have the building, which is supposed to have undergone weakening of the steel when the temperature was nowhere near suitable. The fires didn't burn hot enough or long enough to cause the steel to weaken, much less melt. And then you have the building collapsing in a time approximating free fall. These are physical impossibilities. So what you're adding is some additional physical impossibilities that appear to be implicit to the photographic record, which indicates that the photographic record cannot be genuine. This is Jim Fetzer, your host, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. We're going to continue on the dynamic duo. Stand by. Today, my special guest is Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration. That's right. He's a prominent Republican who has spoken out in criticism of the government's official account of 9/11, which he considers to be flimsy, flawed, and fabricated. He has focused especially upon the government's account of the aircraft and their role on the events of 9/11, a role that's particularly important in general as a motivator in relation to launching wars against terrorism, invasions of Afghanistan and of Iraq, for example, because if there were not any planes, then there can't have been any passengers on the planes, and if there weren't any passengers on the planes, there can't have been any hijackers, and if there weren't any hijackers, there weren't any Islamic fundamentalists to perpetrate these terrorist acts, and therefore it is his thesis that the government has been manipulating all of this, and that in order to control the outcome and to make sure that, for example, planes would actually hit the towers, that these were fabricated events. In fact, something that you have mentioned today, Morgan, is how, is it John Lear, who is the son of the designer of the Lear aircraft and had associates who were experienced pilots attempt in simulations to hit buildings like the Twin Towers, which are only 208 feet across, to see if they could do it, and in repeated trials they were unable to hit the towers at speeds of about 500 miles an hour? Morgan?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now.
Okay. Hey, I wanted to go back to this media thing that came up in the context of JFK's assassination. I actually looked up in my CIA encyclopedia. It was called Operation Mockingbird back then, to penetrate and control the media, and it was ongoing since the late 1940s. Frank Gardner Wisner, who allegedly committed suicide, the CIA operative.
Wisner was the genius for propaganda for the CIA.
Yes, and the encyclopedia kind of tries to play the middle of the road, and they said there were only 400 journalists involved, but the CIA assets, it uses that language, were ABC, NBC, CBS, AP, Time, Newsweek, UPI, Reuters, New York Times. They go on. There are about 25 major news organizations.
This is scary. This is scary, Morgan. I mean, is there anybody out there we can trust? This is part and parcel of why I believe the Internet and talk radio are the last bastions of free speech and maybe the last vehicles for seeking truth.
Look at Rosie O'Donnell expressing skepticism about the government story on The View, and her job is at risk.
Being pummeled not just by O'Reilly, but by an onslaught of those who want to, you know, trash her for this. I mean, and it's such a modest effort. It's heroic on her part, but I mean, it's relatively modest in terms of raising issues. I thought we were, in America, entitled to do that, Morgan.
Well,
I guess I must be wrong.
Yeah, I guess you're just so pre-9/11 in your thinking there, Jim. Right, it's we did one sharp right-hand turn into neo-fascism almost immediately, and you wonder where, hey, if America doesn't wake up, we're going to go the full route, aren't we?
It's stunning. You know, there's a poll online about Rosie, and I think anyone who has the chance to go there and support her would be terrific. Here it is, I'm looking now. The numbers look all wrong to me because most of the numbers here were claiming that that Rosie has crossed the line and that it's not a valid debate, but everything I can see, the numbers are precisely the opposite. yes, he crossed the line, 62%, no, it's free speech. I wouldn't be surprised, Morgan, if this was exactly the reverse of the actual numbers coming in, because we know that some 81% of the American people don't trust what the government has told us about 9/11. So I cannot believe that 62% would suggest that she crossed the line.
Well, I had an email here from Russ Gerst, who we both met over the weekend.
Yeah.
And he was listening to this Stephanie Miller show this morning and heard the claim that the ratings of The View are up considerably.
They've had more than 600,000 additional viewers since Rosie came onto The View.
Right, and her outspokenness is adds value to viewers.
Absolutely it does. It's part of the charm. I mean, if Rosie has the courage, she has more cojones than most men, Morgan, admit it.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And, hey, especially when she's saying some things that are outside the mainstream, and, hey, they may not be that daring to us, but it's great to hear it.
Desperately need to be said.
Oh, yes. And recall back when 9/11 was still a fresh event, when Bill Maher got taken out from his prominent...
Correct.
Right, and then you look at the Dixie Chicks, just about anything Charlie Sheen apparently hasn't, we don't know, he's lost any opportunities here, but the point is that this atmosphere of intimidation is very strong.
It's stunning and it's suffocating. Let me just mention something that may tie in with both of these issues, you know, the tendency to beat up on anyone who speaks out about 9/11, but also your request for correction to the NIST. There's been a development today that you may or may not be aware of, where a leading figure in defense of the official government account has switched sides. This is Dr. Frank Greening, who has now come out with a striking criticism of the NIST report. And I can't help but believe that this was affected by reading your request for clarification, Morgan, yours and Ed Haas and Judy's. So here's something he says about the NIST report, which is, I think, quite a blow to those who want to defend NIST, for whom he has been a champion. In truth, the NIST report is seriously flawed in many respects. It is inconsistent and contradictory in the way it treats the tipping of the upper section of each tower. It assumes that global collapse ensues without modeling the collapse. Its fire simulations generate such a wide array of temperature profiles as to be essentially useless. Its assumptions about the loss of thermal insulation are mere speculation. It ignores the important effects of massive releases of corrosive gases in the fires. Its metallurgical analysis of the steel is perfunctory. It ignores evidence, micron-sized spheres, for the presence of molten iron in the towers prior to collapse. It mentions sulfidation, which it does not explain, while ignoring chlorination. And finally, NIST still cannot explain the collapse of WTC-7 after 6 years of trying. That's quite a nice statement from the former person cited as the leading scientific proponent of the government's account, Morgan.
It is, and as you know, yeah, you're going to have Dr. Judy Wood on tomorrow, I believe. But
yes.
She makes about a three-page issue out of this tipping, which relieves stress, certainly on the section that's tipping away from, and it eliminates any pressure for a pancake collapse or any kind of pulverization, et cetera. So that'll probably be at issue tomorrow. But that's good news as far as I can tell. I did see that email regarding his statement.
Yeah, pretty interesting.
Very, very. And, hey, this is the truth has legs and their lies do not.
I know, Morgan. It's so easy to lie. The inherent advantage the bad guys have, it's easy to lie, and it can be very difficult to explain why a lie, especially a cleverly contrived one, actually is false, because you have to go through the whole process of elaborating the evidence, certifying its authenticity, explaining the reasoning, establishing the logical connections
right.
between the falsification of the lie and the actual evidence. It's a tedious and demanding process, which liars don't have to encounter. I think Bush, you know, is superb. I mean, this is his area of specialization, the lie.
I mean, if they gave a PhD in decedent
defense, that number will increase to 75%.
My special guest today is Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist in the Department of Labor in the George W. Bush administration, who has become perhaps the most prominent Republican critic of the government's account of 9/11. We've been talking about a request for correction to the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which has been carrying the water for the government in attempting to justify something that would roughly approximate the official account with great difficulty. And Morgan's submission, along with those from Ed Haas and Judy Wood, constitute what are, in my opinion, a massive assault upon the integrity of NIST in forcing them to shape up or ship out on their fabricated data and phony account of what's going on here, which violates laws of physics and engineering, and in the case of if we were to turn our attention to the Pentagon of aerodynamics as well. We have another caller, Morgan, for you. It's Michael from Oklahoma. Michael, are you there?
Hello, Jim and Morgan. Thanks for the discussion.
Welcome to the show.
I was wondering if either of you caught Kevin's show yesterday.
No. Tell me about it.
Well, there was what I thought was an interesting guest on, in as much as he presented what I thought was a very interesting theory about at least part of the destruction of the towers as observed.
Yes.
And that is, his name is Christopher Brown, and he believes that the mechanism for the destruction of the towers was actually built into them at the time of construction. And specifically, he points to a two-hour documentary that was done called, it was a PBS documentary called Construction of the Twin Towers from 1990, which evidently is no longer available anywhere. But he says that part of one of the main themes of it was construction delays having to do with getting welders who could make certain welds and be security cleared for the rebar that was sunk into the large concrete box that was essentially the center of the towers.
Yeah, the 47 core columns.
Yeah, like the big columns essentially ringed the outside of this box in which the staircases and elevators and hallways were.
Yeah.
The core. I don't know the thickness of what that concrete box was, but it was reinforced with rebar, and prior to it being poured around, the concrete being poured around the rebar, all of the rebar was coated with some kind of white plastic, a thick coat. So it was this guy's hypothesis that that white thick coat around all the rebar, which caused the necessity for the welders to have security clearances, was in fact some explosive like C4.
Yeah, but I'm skeptical. To my knowledge, there is. I've looked at a lot of bathtub pictures, the lower, the sub strata down seven stories, and there is no gigantic rebar concrete. Those the towers are anchored in bedrock. And furthermore,
He wasn't talking about the big explosions at the bottom.
Well, the towers, of course, were not destroyed from the bottom up.
I know, but there's a concrete interior box, a rectangular box.
How big is this box? Is it? Are you saying it's 180? What is it? The core is roughly, help me out here, Jim. I think it's
like 4 inches thick. The steel columns at the base were 4 inches thick.
Well, I mean,
a quarter inch at the top.
It's about 130 feet by 70 feet. The core, you know.
Well, the core itself. Yeah.
That sounds right.
What I'm intrigued by, Michael, is that seems to me to be a better theory, even if it's not a terribly good one, than thermite, because, for example, we've only been able to establish patents for for the use of thermite and thermate that can cut 2 inches of steel, and since at the core it was, the base of the core was 4 inches thick, that would mean you'd have to have thermate on both sides of the steel, presumably. How you get into the interior of these steel support columns to plant that thermate is incredibly difficult to imagine, and it would require a staggering number of these implantations. So I kind of like your theory, theory that's being offered better than that, even though I don't think it's going to pan out either. But it does tend to suggest that we got to look at this whole situation in a much greater detail, as Judy, for example, has been doing. When this fellow Greening is, offering his criticism of NIST, he's also offering a new theory of his own, to wit that the Twin Towers were pre-primed with something called ammonium perchlorate. I don't know if this could be consistent with what you're talking about, Michael. This is a component of rocket fuel that ignites explosively at around 500 or 600 degrees Fahrenheit. The question here may be whether Greening is really serious about this theory or not, but the point is he's disagreeing with both Steve Jones and with Judy Wood about it, and it requires us to look systematically at a wider range of hypotheses, which is what I've been advocating now all these months since November 11th, when I had Judy on and we started talking about the massive destruction, the selective destruction, the toasted cars and all of that. So I like having this broader mix of hypotheses tossed together.
Well, the advantage to the thought of having those concrete sections loaded with C4 from the beginning is that C4 will not go off unless with a detonator. So it would be safe to use, so to speak, for as long as the time existed until they wanted to bring it down. And two, thinking about it, it seemed to resonate to me in a matter of proportion from what we actually saw. We can see that it exploded from the center. And if explosions were set toward the exterior of the building, that would have been obvious as explosions.
Well, tell you what, Michael, let's hold this off until tomorrow when I'm going to have Judy Wood on. And if you like, give us a call again and we'll talk about this, okay? Can we do that? Because Judy's in a better position to address it than Morgan.
Okay.
Or I, but we'd be glad to pursue it. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo, with my special guest Morgan Reynolds. We're discussing 9/11 and we'll be right back. I mentioned at the top of the show that there are two new books out now. One's called The 9/11 Conspiracy, The Scamming of America, and the other is Debunking 9/11 Debunking by David Ray Griffin. And Amazon has these books combined in a package. If you go to the 9/11 Conspiracy, you'll find you can buy the two books together at a special discounted price. I recommend that highly. The 9/11 Conspiracy, which I edited, has contributions from 11 experts on different aspects of the case, including a fascinating article about the aircraft by Morgan Reynolds and Rick Reiter. And Morgan, something I like very much about your article is your chapter, not only that it's very well reasoned, but that you actually address your critics. You take up a series of criticisms here. And I wonder if we might spend a few minutes talking about those, since there has been kind of a mixed reaction to the very idea that you have been propounding here, that we could have been deceived by fake film.
Right. Well, before we go there, let me make one point that's really an overall picture about the NIST report.
Sure.
NIST has, of course, a lot of prestige. They've got over 200 experts. Over $20 million was spent. This is quite aside from the report that they're supposed to issue on Building 7. But what is going on here? We all know, in truth, that it is the trappings of science in the service of power. It is really not a search for the truth, as science, as we ordinarily accept it to be.
Rather now is for the role of the FBI in covering things up rather than in investigating.
Right. And, of course, it has an initial run, just like you were talking about how easy it is to lie and even fabricate plausible lies, whereas the rest of us have to spend an awful lot of time uncovering and proving that they are lies. In the request for correction itself, I say the following. For unknown reasons, NIST relied on obviously fraudulent data, for example, faked videos, for its analysis. If NIST engaged in conscious fraud, as is likely, the British would call it fixing the intelligence to fit the policy.
That's right.
So,
which is, of course, what the Downing Street memo showed was being done by the Bush administration in preparation for invading Afghanistan and Iraq.
Sure. Okay, so you want to discuss the brief replies to our critics.
Yeah, well, what's nice about it, Morgan, is you bring out the criticisms, and I think that's valuable. I even like starting with the last one first. You talk about the eyewitnesses who say they saw an airliner crash into the South Tower, and you have multiple responses to that. I would add, by the way, there were ear witnesses, too. You know, it's interesting, even William Rodriguez, who, of course, was the hero of the North Tower, the senior custodian, the last man to leave the tower, has taken some exception here because of his hearing or the building respond to the impact of an airplane. But, you know, he's inside the building. He's not seeing what's causing that effect that he's interpreting as the impact of an airplane on the building. And while I'm not going to say categorically that he is wrong, it's possible that he's imposing an interpretation on a fact that might have had a different cause.
Right, and as I understand it, he relies heavily on friends or acquaintances who claim they saw such an event, an airliner run into the tower, so he puts a lot of stock in that. You can't blame some people for that. But yeah, he wasn't an eyewitness to these alleged crashes. But you know, the witnesses are very much a mixed bag. Nobody can point to the witnesses and say they're uniform in that. Oh yeah, we have thousands of people we can bring forward, and they all are going to give you the same story. That's just not true. For example, if you look at the ABC coverage on that day. You see, there's a reporter down there at the World Trade Center, Don Dollar, and he all of a sudden says, "Oh my God, there's a big explosion in the building," and Gibson, Charles Gibson, and Diane Sawyer are the anchors.
Yeah.
And Charles says, "Oh yes, we just saw a second plane go in," and da 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 da. And Dollar said, "What? Oh, I guess I was blocked by the building." So that's just one example of an eyewitness. So,
well, it's interesting that the anchors would be in the position to say that they'd seen a plane hit the building when the guy on the ground there couldn't.
Right. And then you have all these other problems with eyewitnesses. You can have actors. Some of them in these videos are not credible to me, but hey, I'm on the other side of the argument. Maybe I'm too hard on them.
Well, there's that one guy who pops up to explain why the buildings are collapsing or are being destroyed when no one, never before in history of structural engineering, has a building collapse as a consequence of fire.
Right. And then there's memories are plastic, and we're all influenced by the media. There's one interesting study that I cite a few years back in Nature magazine where they pull this trick on people, and they Photoshop the pictures, and they tell people about an event in their childhood that never occurred, like you went up with Dad in the balloon, the hot air balloon.
Yeah.
And 40% of the people they believe it because they've got photographic proof, and they start telling you a story about that day. So this is how people can be psyoped. And then you have the issue of there could have been drones, missiles, or even a Boeing aircraft. I've supposed that could have had stealth technology where there is an explosion, but then the plane disappears, quote unquote. It turns blue sky.
Uh-huh.
So the where it all goes is that the eyewitness testimony is inconclusive, and if you had a really you can't just believe all these casual things. You got to get people under oath and with a hostile examiner, interrogator.
cross-examination.
Yes, and see if it'll really hold up.
And of course, your points about comparing the physical evidence with the witness testimony is impeccable, too, given, however, that we're challenging some of the, you know, evidence here, the photographic record, which is, it's a very complex business, but you're certainly allowing the possibility that something might have hit the towers, just that it may well be something different than what's recorded in the visual images in the film.
Right. For example, you know, the really the person you could point to as starting us down this road is the web fairy, Rosalie Grable. At first she toyed with the hologram, the idea of some kind of an image, three-dimensional image.
Yeah.
She abandoned that, but she's somehow convinced that a pack of missiles went in the North Tower where we have the least amount of evidence. Well, I'm not... We don't have enough to prove that up. Like you say, it's okay to speculate and explore hypotheses, but
you know, Morgan, I'm looking at my computer screen and I'm moving my cursor, and it could have been something as simple as having an image where it was possible to move a cursor that they had the image of an aircraft that was going to be computer generated, so that you could just take footage, actual live broadcast of the Twin Towers, and bring in an aircraft and simulate its appearance there. We'll be right back with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. We're talking about research he's been conducting on the planes involved on 9/11, or at least the planes that are alleged to have been involved in 9/11, and especially we're talking about his research with Rick Ryder, an MIT graduate student, about the Twin Towers. Morgan, just if we can get to maybe two other criticisms in the time we have before us. The garage door theory posits that explosives or thermite on board the plane or in the tower blew an opening sufficient to allow an intact plane to enter, which I think is a thesis that's born out of the butter plane phenomenon, that the plane seems to enter the building so smoothly and effortlessly. And yet I would presume that you find that the evidence is inconsistent with that. Certainly the photograph that I saw this weekend doesn't show any indication of there having been any blowout, any opening of the garage door to allow the plane in.
No. Yeah, that's one of the serious defects of this theory, is that the videos kind of create the problem that leads to the garage door theory, but the videos themselves refute it, that there is no garage door opening or gash in the building immediately preceding the entry of the plane.
Yeah.
But they're also trying to deal with the fact that the planes virtually completely disappear. And I would argue that a little airplane debris shows up has been planted. Now, NIST, in my request for correction, actually models this thing, and it's almost like they believe their own model, and they claim that the total aircraft debris outside the tower in the base case for the South Tower is 55,800 pounds. Well, that's 40% of the alleged weight, operating weight of a 767. Where is all this debris? There would have been an enormous amount below the impact zone, as well as, they claim, a large amount of it on the opposite wall that would have been expelled off into the plaza and beyond. And yet, you can't... Give me an engine, for example. They show you this one lame little turbine part that experts claim is actually... likely apart from a Boeing 737, a considerably smaller
interesting, because that's what we have at the Pentagon, too, one sort of turbine part that doesn't come from a Rolls-Royce engine on a 757.
This is a plantable thing. So the debris story is outrageous, and I point this out in that there is no evidence that you've offered that all this airplane debris is there. An engine... Here's another thing that they say that is really silly, and that is they claim that an engine decelerates in their modeling 10 to 20%. Well, the engine would be the last thing to decelerate because that's what's powering the aircraft, allegedly, at over 500 miles an hour. And the engine actually could conceivably miss encountering a floor and actually power on through the other side of the building. And so the idea that an engine would be the decelerate 10 to 20% while the rest of the plane would not is an absurdity.
Sure, in terms of physics, the heavier particles going at the same speed are going to travel further.
Yeah. And then
what about that so-called landing mechanism? You know, there was a landing gear that was on the street that was allegedly from one of the impacts.
Oh, yes, right. There's some allegedly at West and Rector, south of the Trade Center complex, and then there's some at Murray and Church. Yeah, Judy and I go to great lengths to show you how absurd the landing gear is at Murray and Church, northeast of the Trade Center. The pictures keep on changing. There's dust on this Greco-Roman column in the gutter in one picture. In the next picture, it's clear. The thing is closer to the curb in one, and it's not in another. It's under new scaffolding in one picture and old scaffolding under another. And it's virtually impossible to have landed under this scaffolding, include the buildings that were would have been an obstacle to it, and on and on. In other words, there's not a none of this makes any sense.
Could that stuff have been lying there under a tarp until the time
yes.
was required to pull a tarp off to expose it?
Absolutely. That would be the plausible explanation. Here they pulled the tarp when they found it necessary.
Now, I think without any doubt the most serious criticism that's been raised about your views claims that the kinetic energy of the plane hitting the building would have been sufficient to enable it to enter the building in a relatively effortless fashion. What is your approach or response to that?
Yeah, that one contains the seed of its own destruction within it. And namely, if you have this powerful aluminum can, because of its speed, and it's true that this kinetic energy increases a square of speed, so they sort of have an initial plausible premise. But the trouble is that if you have little or no deceleration, the plane would exit the other side because it would be carrying the same 4 million, or is it billion, joules of energy. So, in other words, what would happen in fact is that this
4 billion, according to your written text, yeah.
Yeah, and of course Rick is the real expert on that. But this building is so strong, the concrete and steel there, it would dissipate this energy virtually instantly. A real crash, and you've talked to me about this, I had to put out another paper to in effect show what would really happen, would an aluminum plane would crumple and break, and there'd be a lot of chaos rotating and torquing. Parts would shred, and the thing would be just destroyed, impaled on this building.
I think it would be great if you could create some simulations or models. They could even be diagrammatic as to what should have happened if the plane had hit the towers the way the government claims as opposed to what is shown in the videos.
Right, yeah. You're going to have a conference you're hosting in early August in Madison.
That's right.
I think that's our aim, is to produce such a complimentary paper to work we've already done.
That's right. Anyone who wants to learn about the conference, which is going to focus on the controversial aspects of scientific research on 9/11, should go to 911scholars.org. There's a nice description of the conference, and more information will be forthcoming right at the top right of the page, 911scholars.org.
Hey, Jim, it's interesting. I'm looking at my notes, and while we don't have an engine, one of these engines has a lot of structural integrity, a lot of stainless steel, titanium, and other parts, and it's 5 or 6 tons, and in a normal crash, engines are highly identifiable. Well, we may not have had an engine, actually, at any four of the sites. But we did find Al-Sukami's passport.
Well, you know, I think that a lot of the American population is beginning to appreciate that there are a lot of oddities involved here with 9/11, that the government's account can't possibly be sustained, and that I think more and more the research community, Morgan, is beginning to appreciate that you're raising very important issues about the authenticity of the evidence related to the plane crashes in New York City as well as elsewhere, which is less controversial. And I just want to compliment you on doing this. It takes a great deal of intellectual integrity and moral courage to pursue these issues. And I want everyone to know that if they're interested in reading Morgan's work and to evaluate it for themselves and to try to reason through some of these difficulties, they can find it in a chapter in the 9/11 Conspiracy, The Scamming of America, which is just now appearing on Amazon.com and on the bookshelves of your local bookstores. Morgan, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I look forward to doing it again. Is there anything you'd like to add as a final thought?
Let me plug my website, nomoregames.net, and you'll find a lot more.
Nomoregames.net. This has been Morgan Reynolds, former chief economist in the George W. Bush administration, and this is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Thank you for listening.